from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School.
This is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball, the show where my three favorite topics, statistics, business, and sports collide. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics here at the Wharton School. Some combination of myself and normally Shane Jensen, Adi Weiner, or Cade Massey are here every week here on the podcast edition of Wharton Moneyball. But for those of you that have been listening to our show, know that in those weeks where it is just me, well, two things either happen. Either you hear me, Eric Bradlow, talk to myself for 2 hours, which I find a lot less interesting, or I bring in a guest host, and I actually, in all the times I've been doing this show over the past 8 years, I've had the same guest host. So I'd like to welcome back to Wharton Moneyball my, as I said, multiple-time guest host, friend, fellow Wharton alum, avid sports fan and sports owner, and co-president of D&H Distributing, Dan Schwab. Dan, thanks for co-hosting with me today.
Honored to be here, Eric. Thank you.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to someone that's passionate about sports. And also, since you're an actual business owner, unlike what, you know, the rest of us professors do for a living, one of the things that's extremely unique about today's show is we're going to talk about how sports really does translate to business. And I know that's something you're very excited about.
I think there's a lot of analogies to be drawn.
And we're gonna do our best to do this. And for those of you that know, for the last 2.5 years, we've been having COVID as the first segment. You know, and as our producer Matt Datz has discussed with us many times, we're gonna decide whether over the next, you know, month, 2 months, 6 months, whether that still makes sense. But for today, it's gonna be 2 hours of sports and analytics. So, Dan, let's get started. And actually, my co-host, who's not here today, Cade Massey, will be happy that I'm talking about this without him here. For those of you that know, he hates it when I talk about this because he doesn't consider it a sport. I do. A very important event in the Bradlow household was just yesterday on July 4th, which was the hot dog eating contest, which, as people know, is supported by the IFOCE. If you have an acronym, in my view, you're a sport. That's the International Federation of Competitive Eating. Joey Chestnut won. He's now the 15-time mustard belt champion. The women's leader, Mickey Sudo, she won. She's now the 8-time women's belt champion. And what was interesting to me, and then I'd love your perspective on this, Dan, whether you think it's a sport, what are the types of analytics, but not only did they win, but they won thinking, how is anybody in the next 10 years ever going to catch them? And it also doesn't appear that there's much of an age curve because Joey Chestnut's nearing 40. Mickey Sudo's also nearing 40. So in my view, they're just better than everybody else. So let me start with a series of questions. Do you consider the IFOCE and hot dog eating, do you consider it a sport?
I probably don't consider it a sport. However, if it were a sport, Joey Chestnut may go down as the most dominant athlete of all time. I mean, with Serena, with Jordan, with all the greats. I think it's on the cusp, to your point. It's got an acronym. It's on primetime TV on the weekends when you normally were watching sports. I think it has as many fans and people watching it as most sporting events. When we think about athletic endeavors, usually eating does not come to mind, but there's no doubt there. Again, there's a lot of analogies between the training and the preparation and the will to win.
So, by the way, I don't know how much of it you watch, but the announcer, there's two brothers that basically run it and own it. George Shea, who's the president, and his brother, Richard Shea, who's the announcer. They do make that comparison. You know, they always put up Joey Chestnut, 15 titles, Rafa Nadal, 14 at the French, Bill Russell, 11 titles, Yogi Berra, you know, so they love putting up these analogies. But I agree with you. It is something you can train for. And actually, as we're an analytics show, I bet there is an analytics study one could do about optimal pacing, optimal training, maybe optimal way to eat hot dogs. I mean, don't you agree? There could be an analytics of hot dog eating.
Well, there's clearly technique as part of it. For someone literally to be able to eat 6 or 7 hot dogs per minute, more than one every 10 seconds, there's got to be strategy behind it. But again, in many ways, for you and I as laymen, it defies the law of bodily function to be able to put that many in your body.
So let me ask you now, as a business owner, again, as I mentioned, Dan is the co-president of D&H Distributing with his brother. I wanted to ask you, let's imagine we consider hot dog eating a peripheral skill. In other words, what I mean by that is it's not your, let's call it pure gray matter intelligence. Maybe it has nothing to do with work experience. How do you, as a business owner, when you're thinking about bringing someone in, imagine Joey Chestnut, imagine two people that had identical resumes, but one of them had 15 mustard belts. How would you use that information when you were evaluating someone as a potential contributor to your business?
I would evaluate it twofold. One, again, going back to considering it an athlete, I put that person in high regards. As a business owner, you love people that are competitive. You love people that are willing to put in the hours and effort to do what it takes to win. And those are the type of people you want on your team. One of the donations, however, is it's an individual sport. So in business, you could have individual performers, maybe in sales, in some roles, it works well. But oftentimes, it's the people that make the entire team better. So it doesn't necessarily make the individual a great leader if they're a great individual contributor. And a lot of times, you really look for both skill sets.
Since you're actually, again, let me ask you also as a business owner, I could imagine making two arguments and just tell me which one you think is most dominant for yourself. One is you hire, and we're going to, when we talk about sports, we're going to get to this in the Warriors and Dynasty in just a second. How much do you think about hiring superstars who on the one hand are great performers, but you could argue they're motivating or demotivating for other people? Like you could imagine like the person that came in second, Jeffrey Esper. He's 40, you know, forget his age, doesn't matter. He's like 20 hot dogs behind. The same is true for Mickey Sudo. You could imagine the other person saying, I'm never going to catch that person. So how do you view people who, you know, I'll just use the language of statistics, someone whose first order statistic is so much higher than the second order statistic. Therefore, I can never beat Carl Lewis in the race. I'm never going to be better than that person. Therefore, maybe it's motivating or demotivating. How do you view it as a business owner?
I view it as the individual, in this case, or team or what have you, that second, third, or fourth best are just as valued to an organization because sometimes those people actually are better fits to the organization. So it's not just the singular nature that this person is that much greater because in most roles in a company, it's not singular in focus, right? It's multidimensional.
Right. And as you're pointing out, even if it's a salesperson, you need more than one. You got to build an entire team. And just because you're not number one doesn't mean you can't be extraordinarily valuable, which is actually brings us to another perfect segue, in my view, to something else that we should be talking about, which is the NBA. Obviously, as you know, the Warriors just won their in the last couple of weeks. The Warriors just won their fourth title. And I think it's 7 years or 8 years.
8 years.
8 years. Okay. And I want, and of course there's been like a core, really there's been a core three. You could add Iguodala to that if you wanted, although I don't consider him necessarily part of the core. There has certainly been, you know, obviously Steph, Draymond, and Klay Thompson. And so let me ask you in both, you know, we're roughly the same age. I'm a few years older than you, but you know, the dynasties in our lifetimes have been, in my view, clearly the Bulls. Obviously the Bulls were a dynasty, six titles in 8 years. The Lakers, you know, the Kobe Lakers, plus the Kobe Shaq Lakers, plus then the Kobe Paul Gasol Lakers. He won five titles in a small number of years. You could count the Spurs in there. People always forget they won five titles. You know, Tim Duncan has five rings. A lot of people don't remember that, but he does. The first one with David Robinson and then was with Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili. How do you compare this Warriors dynasty to the Bulls, Lakers, and Spurs? Because they all won, you know, four, five, six rings in a compressed period of time.
Well, clearly the question was answered that they are a dynasty, right? So there's no arguing that to be that dominant. I think they're actually right in between, because when you think about it, the Bulls basically were 6-for-6 if Michael hadn't taken time off. When you look
they
would
have been eight. I think you and I both agree the Rockets might not have won those two titles in between. The Lakers, Bulls may have won eight in a row.
Right, 100%. And you think about, you know, whether it's the Shaq Kobe winning three in a row. If you look at it, in some respects, it's you can draw parallels to Duncan, Ginobili, Parker, because they won over a longer period of time. That was 4 over 12 years. You could say five if you include with David Robinson. But in this case, it really is you had these injuries, and then you had, you know, some. They lost twice to LeBron, one because Draymond kicked LeBron, and they were at the time the Warriors were up 3-1 in the series. So they clearly could have won even more of that.
And that was the great, let's remember, that was the 73 win Warriors team. And no one had also come back ever from a 3-1 deficit in the finals.
100% agree. And they're still, again, assuming that they sign and they're able to continue with Clay, they still got the core of their team. So from my standpoint, I think it's closer to the Bulls than it is to, in that case, San Antonio, because San Antonio was over a much longer time period. And they ran into some different dynasties or smaller dynasties, whether it be the Lakers. But in this case, I think they've really separated themselves from the balance of the pack. More, again, closer to the Bulls, not quite the Celtics of the 60s, winning 11 and 13, but you can make an argument.
And by the way, all of our listeners are on Wharton Moneyball. And again, this is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics here at the Wharton School. We're talking about sports analytics and business here on Wharton Moneyball. And I'm joined by my friend and guest co-host today, Dan Schwab of D&H Distributing. A lot of people listening to Wharton Moneyball are saying, what the hell's going on with Eric? Is he senile today? What happened to the Yankees winning 4 titles in 5 years? So just for my baseball fans out there, I just want to make sure people know I should have remembered the Yankees. And by the way, modulo one hiccup in Mariano Rivera's career, and the Yankees would have had 4 straight titles and 5 titles in 6 years. So we probably should include the Yankees in that as well. But either way, now let's translate this to business. Sure. Obviously, D&H Distributing has been around for a long time. I think as I even read online, I think you and your brother, correct me if I'm wrong, have the two of you been running the firm for about 25 years now?
Not quite, since we've both been presidents for the past 15 years, but the company's been around for 105 years.
Okay, so how do you build a dynasty for the long run? I mean, there will be a time where it's not you and your brother running the firm. So how do you think about both talent acquisition, talent retention, and also, you know, succession plans? I mean, one of the things the Warriors, back to the Warriors, not only do they have great veteran players, but people forget they had 3 players that essentially top 10 picks that barely played this year who are now going to be joining the other players. So how do you build kind of, let's call it, leadership for the long run, stars for the long run? How do you think about building the D&H Distributing dynasty?
I think that's exactly the analogy. It's the dynasty. When you build a team, you want people not for a quarter or for a year. You want people for many years to come. And when you look at it at the senior level, I'll use a line that's often used. You want to hire people smarter than you. You want to hire people that they're great pieces of the puzzle because they have skill sets that are additive to the whole. We're big believers in the Socratic method. You get a lot of really smart people and you include multiple people in the decision. So from a succession standpoint, you really want to bring in people within each of the business disciplines, whether it be logistics, whether it be finance, whether it be in human resources, people that you believe are best in breed. And you need to pay for talent because those individuals pay for themselves. You want the best and brightest in those roles. Those people often are the linchpin to building the future generation of leadership because you really want those people to raise their team, attract more talent. Because again, people want to work with good people. People want to work with people that give them responsibility and are challenging to them. So you really look at it as you're putting together a team and you want to be a dynasty. And every so often you need to add a piece of the puzzle or upgrade a piece of the puzzle because you know that you're weaker in one area than another. So in a sports team, maybe it's your defense needs to get a little bit better, right? Or your 3-point shooting maybe needs to get a little better.
Well, I think it's clear that there's certainly a lot of analogies. Let's stay with the NBA for a second. I want to talk about 2 players who have been very successful in the NBA. And I want your perspective, both of them as NBA players, but also as, you know, how do you balance superstars, but that could come with baggage? And how do you think about that as a business owner? So the 2 people I'm talking about are currently, at least as we're taping this show today, it could change by tonight, by tomorrow, are still Brooklyn Nets. That's Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. Both have requested a trade. Both obviously want supermax deals. They're a little bit different because Kevin Durant still has, I think, 3 or 4 years left on a $200 million deal. But as you were thinking about, if you're thinking about bringing in someone who's obviously talented, but comes with potential baggage, and how do you think about that? And what do you think? Let's start with the NBA side. If you were building an NBA team, would you trade a huge amount of resources for Kevin Durant and or Kyrie Irving? Do you see them the same as differently? How do you view them?
I view them differently. I definitely view them differently. I think that You know, first of all, Kyrie is you know, his max contract will end in 2026. He'll be at the age of 38, so he won't be able to get another supermax deal at that age. And Kyrie, even though he's only 31, again, the difference between the two is, as a CEO, I would not touch Kyrie, because it seems most people look at it as a short-term fix. And in sports, oftentimes you are looking for that piece of the puzzle, and maybe you're making sacrifices to the culture, and maybe you're throwing more risk into your equation by trying to get that piece of the puzzle. But it's a win now mentality, and they're willing to take a higher risk because the reward is so great if they do get those rings.
And as also, Dan, as what you pointed out, by the way, you're trying to build D&H for the long run.
Yes.
In the NBA, I mean, someone's prime might be 4 or 5 years at 6, 7 years. You have to capitalize on someone's prime. And it's different than trying to build a company that's been around for 100+ years and you want another 100+ years.
And going back to the NBA, if there's five players, if you have one player that in hindsight's viewed as a cancer to the team and really disruptive to the culture, when you remove them, you have the ability, as long as you've not given too much away to get that individual, to kind of reshape your culture. In business, there's hundreds of people in many cases, and the impact of that individual, you want someone for a decade or two, and the impact on multiple people in your organization. You don't want good people leaving. You don't want good people being demotivated. Most organizations, D&H is no exception. We work really hard to build a culture. My brother and I meet with every new employee on their first day. We spend 45 minutes with them on their 90th day walking through the company history. At their 1 year anniversary, we have what's called Pizza with the President, where they come up to our office, we order salads and pizza, and the subject is, tell us what you think, we don't want to hear. Because we want them to have a voice. We want people that care. And we know when we have someone that undermines our philosophy, it takes 10 positive reinforcements to make up for those negative reinforcements.
And so let me ask you, how do you evaluate? Let's imagine you're a GM in the NBA. I'm just making this up. Maybe it's not Kyrie Irving. Maybe it's everyone around Kyrie Irving. Like, how do you know it's a given individual and not necessarily the individuals around them? And so maybe he's just got, you know, the old expression in sports, he's just gotten a bad rap. He's fine. It's just a bad rap.
I think it depends. If it happens once, you look at the criteria surrounding it, and I think you can always look for multiple individuals or multiple instances of why something transpired. When someone has the same result multiple times and leaves with such bad blood multiple organizations, I think the risks highlight that it's the individual more so than the circumstances.
How do you think about, you'll see again the analogy between, in my view, the NBA and your business. Obviously, you don't deal in a monopoly business. You deal in a competitive market. So how about, I'm a GM. Well, if I don't sign Kyrie Irving or Kevin Durant, my competitor is. If I don't hire this person or pay the best prices, my competitor is, or give the lowest prices to my, to the people I'm selling to. How do you think about, because one of the things I criticize myself and my peers at the Wharton School. We're great at teaching what I call static optimization problems. We're much worse at teaching, as everybody is, because it's harder to teach competitive problems. How
sure.
do you deal with the mindset of, if we don't get Durant and Irving, somebody else will, they'll be better. If D&H doesn't hire great or drop prices or do this, someone else is going to, and they're going to win and not me.
I think that's valid, that it's never a zero sum game, that all things being equal, if we hire this person, this is the direct impact, where there's always a ripple effect of those decisions. In the business world, if a person has that much risk, then we say go someplace else. We hope you end up someplace else if it risks becoming organizational dysfunction. When you see a strong talent that you want to get and it's a competitive situation, I think you do look at it that this is to our advantage. And maybe it doesn't detriment the other company to a great degree, but if they have specialized talents or skill sets, if it's a cybersecurity individual and you really think this person's a different maker, and you believe this person is a fit, going back to the sports, they make your entire team better, not just their individual skill set. That person becomes incredibly valuable. I think the goal, though, is you want to win regardless of competitors or who knows what industry the individual goes to. You want to get the people that add the most talent to your team.
So let's continue. We're again, this is Eric Bradlow. We're on the podcast edition here of Wharton Moneyball. Obviously, we're replayed throughout wherever you get your favorite podcast, but of course, we're here on Sirius XM. This is Eric Bradlow again, professor of marketing and statistics, and I'm with my guest host, Dan Schwab, co-president of D&H Distributing. So Dan, let me ask you, there's something interesting happened in the NBA draft, which happened a little over a week ago that I thought was interesting, and I wanted to get your perspective. So the person drafted number two in the draft, I'm not going to talk about the number one pick, although I'm happy to talk about Paolo Banchero, who played for Duke, and Mike Krzyzewski for 1 year. But what was interesting about that is he seemed to be the number three pick, and then he jumped to the number one pick on draft day. But I really want to talk about the number two pick in the draft, Chet Holmgren. And the reason I want to talk about him is that his measurables are impressive in one way and concerning in another. So he's 7 foot tall, has like a 7 foot seven wingspan, can shoot the three, has great handle. All of that is great. But he weighs 195 pounds. Now, Dan, you've met me. I mean, I may not be the fittest person in the world. I know maybe I could drop a few pounds here and there. I don't know. But I'm 6 feet and I weigh 195 pounds. And he's 7 feet and he weighs 195 pounds. And I have, remember, I lived in the city of Philadelphia that lived through a very tall number two pick. His name was Sean Bradley. And it didn't go so well. So my question to you, let's first start with, do you agree that we can use analytics? Maybe it's BMI we should look at. Like, his BMI has got to be extraordinarily low. I mean, he's 84 inches tall and he weighs whatever, 90 kilos. So, right. I mean, we have to be able to. So let's start and let's, I'll get to business in a second. Aren't you, or the opposite is, this is the new model of the NBA, Eric. You got to stop living in the past. Why are you using historical data? Because the center position has changed. What we need has changed in the NBA. His upside is really great. How do you think first about Chet Holmgren and his measurables? And then we'll talk about its business implications.
I think his measurables speak for themselves. So when you look at the data, what, you know, his three-point shooting, his free throw shooting, his field goal percentage, they're off the charts, right? So he is an outstanding player. And I think the analogy
in college.
Yep. You always have to draw that comparison. The difference between, say, a Sean Bradley never came across as coordinated. When you would see him dribble the ball up court, he was never fluid. And I think people historically think of the 7 footers in that analogy. I think it changed somewhat with Kevin Durant and a number of others. A lot of European players that are 6'10 to 7 foot and are amazing ball handlers. I really do think the missing equation is the weight, the BMI. And the factor would be, do you say that is enough, right? When you think about what Kevin Durant came out of college, what he weighed at the time. So first of all, they're younger, these individuals. They're still developing. But one of the things, I read an interesting article that talked about certain athletes have asymmetries and certain ones are just expert movement. Like, their coordination is high. And when a player has asymmetries, they have a greater propensity for injury. And they're starting to measure that more because I think that's the bigger risk. Maybe he never gets that much heavier or that much stronger, but he could be effective. He could still be a number three. Maybe he's not a number four or five on an NBA team, but he's a number three. He can shoot. He can move quick. So that's the real question, is you want to bet when you're taking the number two pick, you want longevity. You want someone who's going to be an all-star multiple years and be with you hopefully for a decade.
So your comment to me, which I agree with, there's two aspects I want to pursue. The first is, maybe I've got the wrong model that he's a center. Like, maybe he's not going to be a 7 foot center in the NBA. Maybe he's going to be a 7 foot three or four in the NBA, who's a 7 foot wing guy with big talent. So that's that. Let me ask that. Do you agree? I might be thinking of him as a center. I'm like, how can he be a center at 195?
Yes. I think the game is changing. The game's played more at the perimeter. So I think the nuances, I mean, the centers taking three pointers is through the roof in the NBA. So I do think he may end up more likely as a three or four versus a guy pounding in there all game. Yes.
Yeah. And the second thing you mentioned actually was a beautiful thing about analytics. So I assume when you mean asymmetries, maybe you mean something like, it could be BMI. That's one measure. It could be he's too tall for his weight. But you could also mean something like, you know, I don't know, his wingspan is larger than his torso, or it could be, you know, and it could even be left side, right side, top half, bottom half. There are all of these now body measurements that we can take that can give us, and by the way, let's be clear, as you know, what I put in our notes was that I'm not so concerned about his skill set. I'm worrying about him surviving in the NBA when at 100, forget how tall he is just for a second. When he gets hit by a guy 260 pounds, what's going to happen to him at 195 pounds? So I agree with you that I think injury is my biggest concern.
That would be the gating factor, right? But then again, a point guard who is the whole game somewhat reckless, that they have a greater chance of tearing their ACL and affecting their career. So it really is, there's no one metric or analytics that will guarantee it. Otherwise, people would be nailing their number one picks every year instead of, you know, seemingly, you know, taking the number one pick when the number two, three, and four were much better players. So I think that there are multiple factors that go into it, but I do think we have to start looking at the players today differently than we did historically.
I think also for our analytics, now obviously we have analytics listeners, sports listeners, business listeners, hopefully a combination of all three. This is also a question, even if you collected historical data, I think this is Chet Holmgren's clearly going to be an issue about extrapolation. In other words, you're definitely going to be extrapolating out of the range of data. I don't think we've had us, even if you were trying to predict, as Dan described, the probability of injury or his upper bound and ceiling or the number of you know, all-star teams he's going to make. I don't know that we've ever had a 7 foot, 195 pound player. So if you did a scattered plot of the data, he's going to fall entirely at the, you know, at a boundary condition. And then the question is, would you even trust your predictive model? It's based on old data, an old style of NBA. There's lots of reasons. I don't know about you, Dan, but I'd be very concerned about using that model to predict his success.
No, I think this historical data may not prove accurate, and he may become an outlier one way or the other. So his results may not be indicative of future results.
So maybe just to wrap up quarter one, just one more topic in the NBA. There was just, and this one, I really do want to get your perspective, not just on the player, but also on how you think about it in business. So Rudy Gobert, very accomplished player in a number of dimensions. Just got traded from the Utah Jazz. He got traded for 4 first round picks and 5 players. And I was thinking to myself, what? This guy is a great example of he's a really good defensive player, maybe one of the top 10 defensive players in the last 20 years. He's a really good defensive player, but he can't shoot from the outside. He's not even a great mid-range shooter. And it's not obvious that his defense is that great on perimeter players. Let's imagine he's covering Chet Holmgren. Can Rudy Gobert cover a guy that's 7 foot with handle, 25 feet from the hoop? That's not obvious. And so what's your assessment both of Rudy Gobert? Would you have traded him? Well, you would trade him for 4. Would you give up 4 first rounders and 5 players for him? And secondly, as a business person, how do you think of people that might be ridiculously good on one dimension, but maybe on other dimensions, it's not an area of strength? How do you think about it, the NBA side and the business side?
On the NBA side, it depends on the organization. So when you think about it, you know, great interior defense really shouldn't be a priority in today's world when you're focused on and the focus is perimeter shooting. However, sometimes the teams that win zig when others zag. So potentially go big inside, bully the small ball lineups. You've got Carl Anthony Towns, who's not a very good interior defender, but he's great on the inside and offense. So again, I go back to the analogy of pieces of the puzzle. So it's right. Easy to see the logic and the counterbalancing. And also the Timberwolves having this maybe all-in mentality to try and, you know, we're in the prime of Cat's career. He's going to be 27 next season. So for them, it's a piece of the puzzle. Look at the Bulls.
And they've got guys, by the way, that can score. Cat can score. It's what, Anthony Edwards, right?
And
their number.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. He can score. Matter of fact, I'm fine with Gobert taking almost no shots.
100%. Again, the analogy is look at Dennis Rodman. Look at how valuable he was, being not singular in dimension, but pretty much getting rebounds and play defense was his job. And maybe in this example that Rudy is not the best, rebounder in the league. But at the end of the day, you need a piece of the puzzle to make your other players better. So I think it was rich what they offered, but I think they saw him as being the perfect fit. And again, from a business standpoint, sometimes you lean in, right? Sometimes you say, this on paper doesn't make sense. And it probably makes more sense to us than maybe anyone else. But if the return on the investment is going to be worthwhile, we're willing to take that risk.
Yeah, the concern I also have is, remember, they're in the West. So, wow. All right, so now they have to get better than the Warriors, right? They have to get better than the Suns. They have to get better than a team that, in my view, could have been better than all of them except for injuries, maybe the Grizzlies. And so you start to see to yourself, so, you know, Clay, Draymond, and Steph aren't going to be able to play forever. That's my question is, who's going to still be standing? And I think at most they have two more years. I just don't think their bodies will hold up. Who's going to be that team in two or three more years that can take the mantle of the lead team in the West? And that's my question. By giving up all those first round picks, are they going to be the team standing in 3 years that can be the best in the West? Because I don't necessarily see it in the next couple years.
I think you're giving up a lot for the next year or two. When you look longer out, clearly Phoenix has the makings of a young team, as does Memphis. I think they're a different profile than, say, Golden State in that respect. But I think that the risk is when you give those many draft picks, but a lot of teams have done this. They brought in a piece or two of the puzzle, traded the kitchen sink, because you know what? They can get them back over time. I think they don't look out further than 4 or 5 years. I think very few teams have that luxury. I think they're thinking 1 to 3 years, maybe 4 at the most.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, this has been the first quarter of Wharton Moneyball. Hope you've enjoyed us talking about sports and, of course, its relation and analytics, its relation to business. Please stay with us and join us right after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball, the show where sports, business, and statistics collide. This is Q2 of our show from our four-quarter show. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics here at the Wharton School, and I'm here with my guest, co-host, friend, fellow Wharton alum, avid sports fan and sports owner, and co-president of D&H Distribution, Dan Schwab. Some combination usually of myself, Cade Massey, Shane Jensen, or Adi Weiner here. I'm here as the sole regular host today, being joined by Dan in the first quarter of our show. We talked about one of my favorite sports, of course. We can debate whether it's a sport, the IFOCE, and of course, we talked about the NBA. But Dan, obviously, the first time I think in sports I met you had to do with your passion and love for the Baltimore Orioles. And of course, and your passion and interest in the MLB. So why don't we start there? You know, obviously, given I'm a Yankees guy, Adi's a Yankees guy. Obviously, everyone knows Shane is a Red Sox guy. Let's stay in the division, but let's talk about the Orioles. You know, we always like to talk about the teams that are, you know, way, way, way at the top. But let's actually start about with the Orioles. So when I was preparing for the show, I looked at the standings and I said, wait a second. When did the Orioles start to get to the point where, I don't want to say legitimate, they're not going to win the title this year, but they're a 450 team. They're not an embarrassment. They may win 70, 75. They could get close. Who knows? Maybe they win close to 80 games this year. So number and the second thing I noticed is they've got a winning home record. So how do you see the Orioles' success this year? Was it a surprise to you? And how do you see them, which, by the way, to be clear, they don't have a $200 million payroll like the Yankees or the Red Sox. How do you see them, their success, and are they building with less?
Well, to clarify, they have a $30 million payroll versus the Yankees' $240 million, but we're not going to count that. Their success, in my estimation, is not at all surprising because they're basically following the Astros blueprint. After the Orioles hired Mike Elias and Sig Majal from the Astros, the blueprint really was, and to some degree, it talks a little bit about what happens in basketball or football trying to get lottery picks, is to tank and obtain four first or second picks in an MLB draft. And if you exclude what happened in the COVID season, that's exactly what happened, that the Orioles season mirrors what happened to the Astros in 2014. And it's where a team jumps from a bottom seller to a frisky subpar team. So a good example is 2011, the Astros had the number one pick. 2012, they had the number one pick. 2013, they had the number one pick. 2014, they had a 430 winning percentage. So year four, they made the playoffs the next year, and they won the World Series in 2017. The Orioles had three of the last 4 years. They had the first pick, the second pick, They had a COVID year, and then they had a first pick, and they have a 4.57 average. And remember, it's not just in the first round. It's obviously later rounds as well. So I think you can draw analogies that they're building their team with a leader. So in hiring a GM, you have a leader, and you're trying to get pieces of the puzzle, and they're doing it with a longer-term time horizon, more akin to a business than, say, an NBA or NFL franchise, which seems to be a little bit shorter focused.
Now, obviously, I live in the city of brotherly love here, and I obviously know the term trusting the process. But don't you see trusting the process, which just for our fans that don't know, that means kind of, let's quote unquote, intentionally losing for the purpose of getting better draft picks. Don't you see it, though, as being much different in baseball for a couple reasons? Number one, so similar to basketball, they've now have the lottery. So the team that's worst doesn't guarantee itself the number one pick. And Number two, baseball has much more uncertainty at the top of the draft than basketball does. So do you think that, like, trusting the process works as well in baseball as it would in basketball?
I do not. I think you've got one player on a basketball team of five starters that makes a monumental impact greater than 20%. In baseball, it's really different, right? That not only do you have nine position players, you've got this a pitcher, and I think you've got a much larger roster. And when you draft someone in the NBA, they could be a contributor the next year. They could be an all-star in 2 or 3 years. In baseball, more often than not, the first or second pick doesn't actually make it to the bigs for 4 or 5 years. They ever make it. And by the way, it's even more of a crapshoot. And the NBA, and maybe one or two of the top 10 end up being busts. And baseball, there's been of the top picks the last 15 years, a number of them you've never heard before. You could get the home runs. You could get a Bryce Harper, who's number one, or Gerrit Cole or Steven Strasburg. And if you think about it, go back to the Nationals. The Nationals got Steven Strasburg and then Bryce Harper, who was the building of them becoming, you know, a playoff level team. And I think you could similar analogy that it doesn't work as well in baseball. It's probably even more risk. However, I do think you can draw the same analogy. And as a CEO, you have to decide how often do you bring a manager in that believes in this and change your strategy, because you have to let that run out for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. You can't, if it's just win now mentality, I think they pull the plug much more quickly.
Also, how do you think baseball is different maybe than your own business, D&H, in the sense of, you know, in baseball, let's be honest, the Orioles have players right now, unless they change their payroll dramatically. They have them for the length of their rookie contract, 4 or 5 sure. years. That the problem is those players are going to hopefully get really good. And then, of course, the Yankees are going to offer them $200 million. So that's the problem you face. So how does the length of the contract, as you even mentioned earlier in the show, that you hope you're hiring people for a lifetime, for the culture. How does the length of the contract period differentially affect the Orioles than your home company?
It affects it much more because, A, you're basically hiring a bench player for 3, 4, 5 years down the road. They're not going to contribute to the time. Most businesses don't have that luxury. Now, you do at the entry level because you're bringing in training and you're bringing in some mid-level individuals that you're going to try and cultivate and make them future leaders or future rock stars. But I think in baseball, the clock doesn't start ticking in all intents and purposes until they make it to the bigs. But I think that is the risk, because if you're not willing to lock them up or supplement them with some additional key piece of the puzzle and spend money, which some teams have done. When you look back, whether it be the Royals or other teams over time, you have a pretty good core. And then also you pay for one or two free agents right. that help get you over the hump. I think that's the philosophy that they're trying to espouse and mimic. And it doesn't work. I think for example of when it works, I think there's more likely 5 examples where it doesn't work. But I think it's just a different business practice because they can't follow the same practice as the New York Yankees. They can't just, you know, write a check to last year's National League MVP and add them to the team. So because they're not going to do that, they have to be creative in how they approach it. And they're approaching it differently than a lot of organizations.
You also brought up an important point that I hadn't thought of. You're right. The clock in baseball, when does it start ticking? You hire a senior level manager or bring in somebody in the draft and quote unquote, the clock starts ticking immediately. You can't keep them on the bench for 3, 4, 5. Of course, you can. There, you have, I'm sure, like most companies, you have a career development program for junior people that you're bringing in. But you're right. The length, I was thinking in baseball, you're right. It's not 5 years from when they're drafted. It's the when does the clock start ticking? And you can play all kinds of games with keeping people in your farm system for a while, and that works as well.
Yeah, the analogy I have is when we bring people in from the outside, usually they want to be instant contributors, right? They want to show their merit. They want to earn their keep. And we tell them, we want you taking 90 days, just learn the business, right? Acclimate yourself and identify where you think our gaps are before you know what the answers are, because we hire them for the marathon, not the sprint. So we actually do the opposite. We actually try and ask them to take more of a longer term mentality in their thinking.
Let's go to the opposite side of the puzzle, but in the same division, which is, you know, I have to talk a little bit about the Yankees. The Yankees, as of today, are at a 725 winning percentage. Now, that's an impressive number by anybody's standards. And we're almost at half the season. So I have two questions for you. Three, actually, relating to the Yankees. Does that 725, let's do them one at a time. Does that winning percentage even surprise you, even for their bloated payroll?
720 is pretty rare, but it's not surprising based on their lineup. I mean, they look, you know, I remember looking at their team and thinking it's the better half of an all-star team over the years they put together. And I think of the opposite, you would say that they hadn't gelled, right? Because sometimes you bring in different pieces of the puzzle for whatever reason. They had great talent the previous five seasons. They just didn't turn into a winning combination. And I think today they've improved their pitching, and I think they've gelled as an organization. So I'm not shocked. I think it's incredibly impressive, but I'm not shocked.
Okay, let's go to number two, which is the thing that makes all of us Yankees fans nervous, given, let's remember, everybody. I mean, Shane always says, I selectively pick the number of years. Of course, I don't include 98, 99, and 2000 when they won the title. But since 2000, 22 seasons, the Yankees have one title. So what makes me very nervous is the Astros, because the Astros have an experience in winning. They seem to have the Yankees number. At best, the Yankees are a 500 team against the Astros. So right. Do you agree with me that the Yankees, if the Yankees were to face the Astros in the playoffs, I don't care if the Yankees win 115 games and the Astros, by the way, the Astros might win over 100 games too.
Sure.
It's 50-50, right? At best.
100%. The pitching wins playoffs. That's been proven time and time again. The Yankees have a dramatically improved pitching core. I think Buster only tweeted recently that I think their starting pitchers have pitched 76 out of the first 80 games. They're really relying on this great core of individuals. I think the real risk is that it's their hitting that separates themselves. They have the best lineup in baseball, but how does that do against a dominant pitching staff? In the playoffs, historically, it's shown that pitching wins out. So that's why if I had to pick one of the two, I would still pick the Astros.
Yeah, and that gets all of us Yankee fans nervous, because I'm not saying I disagree with you. But since you just talked about the Astros pitching, let me bring up an Astros pitcher. And one of the things I love talking about here on Wharton Moneyball is what we call age curves in sports. And so Justin Verlander is a freak of nature. I mean, this guy, in my view, is still a top five pitcher in baseball, certainly top 10. He's 39 years old. How do you think about a guy like this that seems to just defy the age curves and is just still pitching? It's like he's the next Nolan Ryan. Are we going to see Justin Verlander pitching for 6 to 7 more years? Like, why? Or next Tom Brady? Why does Verlander have to be done at age 40? Maybe he's not. Maybe he's going to pitch till 45.
Well, you drew the Brady analogy. You could draw in tennis that people are winning, you know, majors at 36. I think in baseball, you know, it's been, you know, he's not 39. He's probably a top five pitcher in baseball. But it's not like it's never been done before. Glavine went 15-7 at age 40, 13-8 at 41. Maddox went 14-11 at 41. He had almost 200 strikeouts when he was 41 and another 200 when he was 42. So I don't know that it goes a decade more, but could he pitch 5 years and still be in the top quartile of pitchers in baseball? 100%. Because I think the players that have shown longevity and ability to stay healthy, clearly, in today's world, whether it's their training, or taking care of their body, they can pitch a lot longer. So I think throwing out the analogies to decades ago is more similar to other sports that's changed than it is to baseball decades ago.
I think also, just to be clear, if I've got this correct, I always get some pitchers mixed up, but Verlander also had a significant injury, right? And he's back from that injury. So the question also is, I'll be interested to see how you think about this for sports. Maybe his chronological age is 39, but maybe because of his injury, you could say his baseball age is less. So how do you measure age? Is it his chronological age, or is it the number of pitches? And maybe even you could, before answering that, or while you're answering that, you could tell me, how do you think of, let's call it, experience when you hire somebody? Is it number of years since, let's say, college degree? Is it the number of years of relevant experience? Is it, so age can be measured in lots of ways. You know, it's the old thing in football too. Do I measure the number of carries of the running back? Do I measure the number of years they've played? So number one, how do you think about age? How do you think about it for Verlander? Could the break be the best possible thing for him? And how do you think about it in business?
I think about it in business. I think the way I would think about it in sports as well, that I wouldn't consider age to be one of the critical statistics, because I think it has more to do with the individual's ability to evolve and continue to improve their skill set as the world around them changes. So someone with 5 years experience could be much more nimble and successful than someone's been around 30 years, or the person with a 30-year tenure could still literally be the person that is progressive and most creative and most capable individual. So I don't look at it from an age standpoint. I think you look at it twofold: the specific experience, what do they have, you know, for pitcher, you know, how many times have you pitched in big games? Maybe it would be an analogy, but what specific experience do you have that applies to this job at our company? And can you make an impact? But also, where is it transferable? How can we utilize the skill set? If we give this individual a larger set of responsibility, can they take on other challenges as well? Have they proven different things, or is it more of a one trick pony? So when I look at it in business, age is not a primary factor. It's more experience, and it's more applicable experience.
So let me ask you, since you brought it up, it wasn't necessarily in our rundown, but where do you stand in the debate of Shohei Ohtani, which is, you know, he's never going to be as great as he can be if he keeps having to be the great pitcher and the great hitter? Or do you view it as, are you nuts? Of course you should use him as both. So how do you think about that? And both in terms of Shohei and baseball, and also when you hire someone, if you have someone, let's say, that is the greatest thinker in some domain, but is also really good in something else, would you rather the person be focused or split their time 50-50? So I'm interested to hear both about Shohei and how you think about it when you're hiring someone who's got such extraordinary skills in multiple dimensions.
Well, I think that's a great analogy. So I think you can 100% look at the data and say, if you specialize in either hitting or pitching, you would most likely be better at one or the other, because you're spreading yourself thin. You can't master your craft to the same degree you can the wear and tear on your body. In business, when I think about someone and giving them a second set of responsibility, it's what is the trade-off? How diluted do they become in their other core skill set in order to get the benefit in the other category? So going back to Shohei, the issue really is, okay, if he could still win 14 games instead of 18 or 19 games and be a top three contributor in hitting, that is a trade-off you're willing to make, because the combined value is greater than any individual value. And I think that look at the same thing. Do you spread this great talent thin because you're going to give something up, or is the other area that valuable, or that person has such a distinctive difference that the impact is greater than what you forego?
So let me make maybe I'm stretching this here, but we're on Wharton Moneyball, so we get to do a little bit of stretching here. Let's talk about the same form of extrapolation that we did with Chet Holmgren in the NBA. We've never really had a 7 foot, 195 pounder before. How would you have talked about the trade-off? Yeah, sure. If Shohei could go from 18 to 14 wins, but you could also get him to hit every day, his wins above replacement on hitting might be worth a lot more than the four wins you're giving up on pitching. How would you even try to measure that? Like, how would you, like, you're not going to run a randomized experiment and let's see, some days we'll pitch him, some days we'll take him out of the rotation, or this year we'll do this, next year we'll do this. How would you even try to evaluate what the ROI trade-off would be amongst these skill sets?
There's no way to measure it up front. You make certain assumptions. In business, you say, I'm going to give this person both sets of responsibilities, and then you're going to reserve the right to get smarter. Let's measure the data every quarter, every month, over a longer period of time, and how are both businesses progressing? What are the key metrics, and how are they trending? So same thing. You may make this assumption with Shohei where he's going to do both, but all of a sudden, if he starts finishing, 7-13, and his hitting is also deteriorating, you may say, we want to focus on hitting, because the delta is no longer what we expected it to be or was previously. So I don't think there's any upfront measurement, but I think as you start progressing, you may not be able to compare it to like situations because there are no like situations, but you can compare it against your own data.
By the way, so Dan, you've given me an opportunity. I think some future show on Morton Moneyball, myself, Kate, Adi, and Shane, we're going to talk about statistical predictions when there are no like situations. And so I think that's one of, and by the way, it's not just about sports and statistics. I think it's about business as well. I think, you know, and by the way, similar to what I just said about Verlander, I don't wish injury on anybody. Of course, Shohei's already had a few. You almost wish there, it's not perfect data, but imagine there were periods where he could only hit but not pitch, only pitch but not hit, and what would happen to his statistics as a pitcher or as a hitter when he could, when he was forced to only do one of the two? As I said, it's what's called endogenous self-selected data, because he might have an injury and therefore he might do better at one or the other, but it would be interesting data to look at for sure.
Absolutely.
Maybe in the last 2 minutes or so that we have before the break, I wanted to ask you. So I'm doing something, I think, you know, in July, a couple weeks from now, my son, my friend of mine and I, we're going to the Hall of Fame. And greatest 50th birthday present family ever got me is a lifetime membership to the Hall of Fame. And I'm going to say, I can't believe I'm going to see a Red Sox go into the Hall of Fame. That's Big Poppy. So as someone that was an Orioles fan, certainly not a Red Sox fan, nor am I, how do you view Big Poppy in the pantheon of Hall of Famers? Is she Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Ted Williams, Cal Ripken great? Or is he kind of in that next tier? How do you view Big Poppy?
He's in that next tier. So he checks the box. So he clearly was the first ballot Hall of Famer. Three times World Series. Played 20 years, which is important for the Hall, right? If you want longevity. 500 home runs, 10 times All-Star. He was top six in the league for MVP six times. So he was always one of the best players in baseball, and he was larger than life, and he rose to the moment. I think that's the one variable that in people's perceptions, they put him on the same data tables as those other companies, or the perception of the pedestal of the top 10 of all time. He's the pack just below that. He's had a large impact. When you look at some of his stats, whether it's his F4 of 51 or his career, you know, batting average. I think he's 182nd among position players and WAR weighted runs. You look at all this data, he was very good, but he wasn't better than everyone in the league by a mile for 5-7 years. He was always really, really solid. You know, you could make the argument he's more of an Eddie Murray type player that didn't have the same personality or didn't have the same panache. Not as good, but I think closer to that than, say, you know, a Mickey Mantle, Henry Aaron.
Yeah, he's no Mantle or Aaron in my view. But either way, I like the comparison actually to Eddie Murray quite a bit. But actually, I think Eddie Murray, as you know, had better career stats for sure. Well, that's been the first half of Wharton Moneyball. Please stay with us and join us right after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Q3 of Wharton Moneyball, the podcast edition. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics here at the Wharton School. Some combination of myself, Kate Massey, Shane Jensen, or Adi Weiner here every week. This week, it happens to be just me of the regular host of the show, and I'm here with my multiple-time guest host, Wharton Moneyball friend, fellow Wharton alum and sports fan and owner and co-president of DEH Distribution, Dan Swab. We're talking about sports. We're talking about statistics. We're now going to move to a sport, Dan, that has some very interesting aspects of it right now, which is golf. And you might say, well, maybe Eric's talking about the fact that we're in the heavy major season. Yeah, that's true. But I'm not actually talking about that. So let's first talk about LIV Golf. And first of all, before we get even to the sports of it or to the analytics of it, as a business owner, how do you think about it? How are you seeing like the reaction of the PGA Tour? How are you thinking about LIV Golf and its effect on the PGA?
From a business standpoint, I view it as, if you're the PGA, you're viewing it as a competitive threat that's not playing by the same ground rules you're used to, right? Because it seems that money is no object. They're willing to do what it takes to buy their way in. And they're willing to incent people beyond any, not even close to what they could make elsewhere, to join their organization to the detriment of their, you know, potentially their brand somewhat in some cases, maybe, but also, you know, they'll probably have to sacrifice something from the PGA standpoint. So I think it's really a challenge. And I think for most businesses, how I look at it is you have to play the long game, that you can't play by the same rules. You don't have the same deep pockets. You can't ask your sponsors to take the purse for this tournament, you know, up 5X or 7X, right? It's not sustainable. The math does not work. So your hope and your belief is that it's not sustainable, the business model that they are running, right? So when the USFL was signing NFL players to these crazy deals, wasn't going to pass the test of time. So I think you draw the same analogy here. Now they've got different levels of financing than we've ever seen before entering sports. The next closest analogy would be wealthy country nations or individuals buying European soccer teams and paying for talent. So I think it is it's a real challenge because it's not the typical competitor. It's not the typical scenario as a business owner that you were ever planning for.
Well, how much do you and your brother worry about, like, if I ask most businesses who their competitors are, like, for example, obviously you're in the distribution business, mostly, I guess, computer electronics and other stuff
sure.
related. What would happen tomorrow if Amazon all of a sudden decided, I mean, in some sense, they are in that business, but a different market. But I mean, how much do you worry about some big, let's call it pocketless company, just basically saying, we're going to forget profits. We're going to take market share. We're going to blow this 105-year-old company out of the water. Who cares about making money? We'll bleed them until they got no money left. Maybe LIV is planning on doing the same with the PGA. I'm just interested how you think about it as a business owner.
I think you think about it from the micro and the macro. From the micro, day in, day out, you run your business within your four walls. And you should not be overly concerned with your competitors. You need to be cognizant of what they're doing, but you control your own destiny. So we really look at from that standpoint, and we do not become obsessive on what our competitors are doing. We want to set our own bar. We want to maybe learn from their successes or mistakes, but we want to maybe amalgamate that information to drive our own business model. The external factors, a macroeconomic impact, whether it be a shift in e-commerce or companies entering your business, there's very little you could do except for if you see the trend. So if you saw the trend in e-commerce and you saw the trend in the building distribution centers, you could say, okay, what are we going to do to prepare if then, right? And you don't overswing the pendulum, but you start taking concerted steps. So if you weren't in the cloud business when you're selling software and you were selling box software, you saw the writing on the wall that you needed to start evolving your business model to become competitive. So I think from the standpoint of a business owner, on a short-term basis, you're just executing. From a long-term strategy, you do look at how the market is changing. And it's not just individual companies entering. It's how the market is changing. And the old, we use a sports analogy, is you want to skate to where the puck is going, not where it is. So you want to spend a fair amount of time. If you are built for the long haul, you have to make sure you're planning out those 3, 5, 7 years as well.
So let's talk about one of the questions I've been interested in LIV for a while now is, so we're going to have, if things continue as they are, LIV golfers cannot compete on the PGA Tour, or even, I think maybe even they've partnered with, I think it's the DP World Tour, maybe even the European Tour won't allow them to play at some point. So maybe they'll be able to compete in the majors. But by the way, you typically need to get world ranking points to compete in the majors, so you may not be able to. How do you think, this is one of my questions I've asked the last 2 weeks, but I'd love your perspective. How are you going to compare golfers who rarely play together? Like, suppose it's 2 years from now and people want to say, I wonder how good Dustin Johnson still is. How good is Brooks Koepka? And essentially, whether it's no data or a small number of tournaments, we've seen Koepka and DJ playing with, you know, Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth and, you know, Scottie Scheffler and et cetera, and Colin Morikawa. How do you think we're going to be able to, or are we not going to be able to rank golfers? Because in the statistical language is we have no overlapping design. We will never see them together. Therefore, it'll just be hard to rank them against each other. What are your thoughts?
I think if they are never playing against each other, you will not be able to rank them. You, on relative terms, you'll be able to identify this person is amongst the best in, say, one of the two tours, but you won't be able to effectively compare their skill sets, right? You won't be able to say which one is better. It's go back in baseball years ago when they had you know, different leagues and they didn't play each other, how could you compare teams? Because in golf, it's even more so because you're playing in a certain golf course under certain conditions.
Okay, so, that's the part that, because I've always said, one of the things I brought up to one of our guests a couple weeks ago is they do have course rating difficulties. But you're pointing out, yeah, but the condition, you can't control for every possible difference that would allow you to put them on a comparable scale. And my assessment is that's what you're saying. They're just, you know, even if you had a supercomputer with a machine learning model that could try to do it, there are just so many things possibly that are unmeasurable.
You could still measure some data points, whether it's greens in regulation or how many putts or success saves out of sand, whatever you want to measure, you could compare those. However, those are just the data points that lead up to the greater. And there's so many other variables. Is the person a winner? Is the person when they are head to head with someone else? Although, you know, can they come from behind? All those things that we love in sports, the data adds up to give them, they have the propensity to be successful. But what actually happens is on the field of play, and that the data can't, they're not playing against each other. You don't have that real life scenario. You just have data points.
As a sports fan, do you think LIV is going to turn out? And again, you know, you and I think are on the same side politically about where the money's coming from and all that, but let's ignore that. That's not our show. Where do you think this, like, do you think this is going to end up being good for professional golf? Or do you think this is just going to be a, you know, a 5-year nightmare and disaster? And, you know, there'll be players migrating. And you even pointed out, I'm sure you've seen this, LIV is actually now bringing in people that have no PGA Tour experience. They're bringing in people from college golf who haven't even gone to the Q school yet. They're investing in the future players. Do you see this with a good ending? Like, is it good for the sport overall, or how do you see it?
I think it's dilutive today, because people like seeing names they know on the leaderboard, right? So I think for the, especially for the big tournaments. And I don't know that, again, depending on how many tournaments, I'll use it from the US perspective. If they don't get a lot of tournaments in the United States, most people aren't watching golf at the time it's played in Europe or Asia or other places. The time difference has an impact sometimes. So I think it's, I don't think it ends well. I think for those individuals, when they're offered this handsome you know, payday, I think it'd be hard for them to look the gift horse in the mouth. It's not like it's a 10 or 15% premium to what they earn. It's dramatic. Who knows? Whether it's successful or not, the question will be, will the viewer will determine that. Will be it just as interesting? Is there enough golf fans that want to watch two different tournaments? What if they're on the same weekend? Are you going to watch it based on who's on the leaderboard? We've never been put in that scenario before. So I think each of them will be looking to figure out how they differentiate themselves. And I'm not so sure, you know, I don't know that the audience is interested in watching two tournaments in one weekend.
Let me also bring something, another relationship between this and business, that let's imagine there was someone, again, I'm here. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics at the Wharton School. We're doing the Wharton Moneyball podcast edition. I'm here with my guest co-host and friend, Dan Schwab from D&H Distribution. Dan, let me ask you a question. Let's imagine there was someone at D&H that took a job. I'll call it maybe stabbed you in the back, took a job that you thought was a loyal person, took a job at double the money at some other place. You guys responded, but to the best of your ability, within your reason. But then they wanted to come back. How would you think? So let's imagine tomorrow DJ says, you know what? Moynihan, I think it's the PGA leader, president of the PGA, said, you know what? I made a mistake. You're right. I shouldn't have gone to LIV Golf. How would you, as a business owner, think about the person apologizes, they make a mistake, they make a public statement to all the employees. How do you think about that?
Well, we always wish for the individual to strive for what's best for them. So if it's a life-changing amount of money for their family, we are supportive. You know, obviously going to a competitive threat is, you know, something that's anathema to us. And we want to do our best to have people want to be with us forever by creating a really special environment. But if someone does leave and go elsewhere, I do think it's, it just depends on the role. At a senior level, I don't believe that individual comes back in the organization. Potentially at a different level, you know, maybe that person learned a lot. Maybe they were young and made mistakes. I wouldn't close off entirely, but there's no doubt if they went and if it wasn't to a competitor and so they left for an exorbitant sum of money, we wish them well. We wish them tremendous success. And if they come back that much smarter and that much more capable and at a compensation that makes sense, or taking on additional responsibility, it's great. When they go to your competitor, it just leaves a different taste in your mouth. Now, in this case, you went from a monopoly to a duopoly, right? So right. In this case, they can't afford, you know, hypothetically, if someone that's loved was to leave, let's say Tiger signed with them and then Tiger wanted to come back, the PGA couldn't say no to him, right? He's too important to their viewership, to their brand, but it would always bother them.
Except the signal value is if you let anybody come back, then everyone's thinking, well, if I can just leave for a short period of time and come back. No, I mean, Tiger's a unique situation.
Sure.
But I would be worried about the signal value. But let's now talk about the golf tournament that's coming up in just a week or so, which is the British Open. One of the things I love to do here on Morton Moneyball. So first for our listeners, let me just read off who the top 10 rated players are in terms of betting odds. And then I'm going to ask Dan my favorite question I love asking anybody. If I had to give you some number of players, you get, let's say, 5 players, I get the field, the rest of the field, you get 7. How many players do I have to give you so you would give me an even money bet? I'll take the field, and you take the top X, and you just tell me how many players you need. So let's first go. First, Rory McIlroy is the top at plus 800. Now, just for our fans, again, what does that mean? It means, forget the betting, what's called the vigorish. If you just took 100 divided by 100 plus 800, they're saying that he's got about a 10 or 11% chance of winning. The next after that is Scottie Scheffler, the number one player in the world. Justin Thomas, who's been playing well, just won the PGA. Jordan Spieth, who hasn't won a major recently, but has been playing well. Colin Moore, he's a plus 1600. Colin Morikawa at plus 1600. Matthew Fitzpatrick, who just won. At plus 1800, Cam Smith at plus 2000, Shane Lowry at plus 2000. I'll just stop. Well, I'll do a couple more. Will Zalatoris at plus 2200, Xander Schauffele at plus 2200. And interestingly, of course, Dustin Johnson, the Mr. Live Golfer, at plus 2700. So I have a bunch of questions, but let me start with you and I are going to make an even money bet, and I'm going to give you the top X golfers. How many golfers do you need for you to feel you're not getting ripped off on this even money bet?
Far more than 5.
Okay.
I would think kind of the dividing line that a individual would pick would be about 10, but I actually think it's higher than that. I think the stats, if you think about it, if Rory is the highest odds at 1 out of 8 chances, and then it gets worse from there. If there were 8 at Rory's level, you would say, okay, then the number should be, I'll take 4 players, right? Because then it's a 50-50 shot. But it right. goes 1 out of 8, 1 out of 12, 1 out of 14, 1 out of 14, 1 out of 16. So it's probably closer to 10 players, because if you just did the simple math and averaged the chances of one of those, it probably is just about 20 to 1. And so yeah, it'd be 10 players.
Yeah. So what's interesting about that is, you know, if you think about it, that shows you. But let's now. I always like to compare it. Let's say baseball.
Mm-hmm.
32 teams in baseball, right? 32.
Yes.
32 sounds right. How many teams do I have to give you in baseball for it to be 50%? Let's go through the major sports here. How many teams do I have to give you in baseball? I get the field. You get the other teams. How
5.
Many do I have? All right. So baseball, it's 5 out of 32. Okay. Let's go mm-hmm. to the NFL. How many teams do I have to give you? I think there's 30 teams in the NFL, right? How many teams
yes.
do I have to give you in the NFL?
More probably, if I had to pick, I would say about 7.
All right. So baseball, let's see here. Golf, you said you want 10, and the NBA, you said 5, and mm-hmm. NFL, you said about 7. Let's go to, I don't know. NHL
and NBA. We also missed.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get to NBA. We said MLB. MLB was about 5. Yeah. NBA. Let's go to NBA first. How many in the NBA?
I'll go with 5 again.
Okay. And NHL?
I'd go with 6.
Okay.
So in that 5 to 7 range for all of those would be where I would say I think the betting line would be.
Okay. And by the way, for all of our listeners here on Wharton Moneyball, one way you can contribute to the show is to tweet at us, which you could get at W Moneyball. So again, that's on our Twitter handle. It's at W Moneyball. I'd love to hear. Dan Schwab gave his numbers. Golf 10. NBA 5, NFL 7, NHL 6, MLB 5. You too can become part of the show. Tweet me your numbers at W Moneyball. You can also send us an email, moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. So that would be great. The other possibility, again, is let me just tell you how I would take your bets, Dan, if this were me. So golf 10. So you're going to get McIlroy, Scheffler, Thomas, Spieth, Morikawa, Fitzpatrick, Smith, Lowry, Salah, Torres, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and Schauffele. And I get everybody else. All right, so for golf, I think I'm taking everybody else. I think I'll give you the 10, and I'll take everybody else.
Okay.
NBA 5. Wow, that's a tough one. That's right on the knife's edge. I think I'm taking the 5. And I'll give you, I would not take that bet at even money. NFL in 7, that's probably right around there because, you know, for me, I think the Packers are in that set. I think the Buccaneers are in that set. I think the Rams are in that set. In the AFC, I'm just trying to even think in the AFC.
Kansas City, Buffalo,
maybe the Ravens. Maybe the Ravens are in that set. But certainly with 7, I think you've got your basis. I take the 7 over the field in the NFL. NHL in 6, I mean, obviously the Avalanche won the title. The Panthers were a very good team. The Lightning were, obviously, they were two-time defending champs. NHL, I think I would probably also go with the 6. MLB, it's hard because we're halfway through the season. But if we talk about next season, MLB, wow. I would just wonder historically, I'm going to look for next week's show. Historically, if you took the top 5 preseason predictions, I'm wondering how many times, that would be another way you could empirically test this.
Sure.
I'm not that convinced that taking the top 5 in baseball would do that great. Because last year, the Braves won, right? I'm not convinced the Braves were in the top 5 predicted teams last year before the season started. But it would be interesting to look at. One of the specific players, though, I wanted you to look at, to talk about this year, and actually I'd love your perspective also on how this does relating to business. So Rory McIlroy,
right?
He has 4, if you use the number of majors, of course he can win. He's got 4 majors. Yeah, but Dan, I know you know that he hasn't won one in 8 years. 8 years. In many cases, many believe the most talented golfer since Tiger Woods has not won a major in 8 years. Let's imagine there's an employee that you were thinking about. The person was great. Great, great performance. They have it in them, but she or he hasn't done it for a while. How do you think about people that you know their peak performance can be really great, but for whatever reason, in the short to medium term, just haven't delivered? So let's start with Rory, but let's talk about it, D&H distributing more generally.
So when you look at Rory, I think today, I think he's still number 2 in world golf rankings. So he's still clearly one of the best players in the game. To me, would not be concerned at all that this person, if you use the analogy of, you know, salesperson of the year or whatever role, they haven't won that in 8 years, because there's a lot of variables that go into it, right? You ran into someone who had the best round of their life. Maybe that type of pressure, you know, this individual doesn't always thrive under that pressure. But that person's ability to be consistently good for an elongated period of time, from a business standpoint, that's what you're looking for, more so than the up, down, up, downs. In fact, if you're building a team and you're building a Ryder Cup, you probably want a guy like Rory on your team than someone that won a major or two in the last 5 years and then has disappeared. So I think that's actually more valuable.
So as we sit here, so I don't know if given our guest for the Q4 is Craig O'Shaughnessy, and we're going to be talking about tennis. If you had to pick right now, who is your pick for the British Open, noting that Rory is playing great? I mean, Scottie Scheffler's had the year of a lifetime, but doesn't have a long track record of greatness. Justin Thomas is always great. Jordan Spieth is playing great. Morikawa's got a couple majors. Fitzpatrick just won a major. Who's your pick for the British Open this year?
I wouldn't call him a long shot, but I'm a huge Will Zalatoris fan just because I'm a big fan of Happy Gilmore, and he looks just like the caddy of Happy Gilmore. He's been on the cusp multiple times. He's been on the top 10 leaderboard on all the majors.
Ended up in second? I know he's come up second in the Masters. Didn't he just recently come up second in the Open? I mean, he's got at least 2 seconds, maybe more.
He is at least 2 in majors. So he's literally been right there on the cusp multiple times. So I think he's a little bit of a fan favorite.
Well, let me ask you one last question before we end Q3 here. How do you think about just winning? Like, for example, do you think any less of him because he hasn't won? He hasn't quite gotten over the title. Do you think of any less of the let's say, the Celtics, because they didn't quite win the title against the Warriors? Do you think any less of the Lightning? They were going for the three-time championship. All they did, in quotes, all they did was make the finals. How do you think about people that kind of lose in the finals? Does that think about, do you degrade them at all? Or do you think of them as, no, that's a feat and accomplishment in itself?
No, I think that's society wanting to crown the victor and putting that the victor on a higher pedestal. I think that, you know, think about Phil Mickelson, who hadn't won for years. You think about the great football players like Dan Marino, who everyone puts in their top five or top seven quarterbacks, never won the Super Bowl. I think even though it's an individual sport, to me, it's not, I would not be deterred at all by that person not being able to get over the top.
I think one of the things we talk about a lot on our show, and I'm sure the same way you guys think about this at D&H, is we try to make things binary, win and lose. I'm sure you guys have a performance-based system that isn't this person's great and they stink. I mean, there's all kinds of grades in between. And matter of fact, there's value in having continuous measures. And I'd love to hear. I'm sure you guys think about it the same way.
There's multiple criteria based on the role that you measure individuals on. And the whole goal is to continue moving up the continuum. How do you improve each of your skill sets, right? And where do you want the individual going? Where do they want to be going? And how do you path them there? And ultimately, just like an athlete, if they have a weakness, it has to be brought to their attention and worked on. And if they're not willing to work on it, then they shouldn't be part of the organization. So it's really healthy and meant to be collaborative for the benefit of the individual. Because if the individual benefits, the organization benefits. So from that standpoint, I think that it dovetails directly into how we think about employee motivation and retention at businesses, providing that feedback with multiple measures, qualitative and quantitative, to give them, people want to be successful. People want to do what's right. So you do their best to avoid any surprises.
And that's the great thing about analytics and golf today. As you know, there are so many dimensions that Will Zalatoris and everybody can measure themselves on. They can measure themselves on driving performance, chipping performance, putting performance, sand saves, etc. And matter of fact, even swing speed, all kinds of things that can say, I need to work on this dimension. So this has been the first three quarters of Wharton Moneyball. We have Craig O'Shaughnessy. We're going to talk to him in Q4 about tennis. Please stay with us and join us right after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball, the show where sports statistics and business collide. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics. And again, I'm here today with my guest host and friend, Dan Schwab, fellow Wharton alum, president of D&H Distributing. One of the nice things, Dan, about Wharton Moneyball is Q4 is, you know, our listeners on our podcast and on SiriusXM 132, they get tired of hearing from us. We just talk sports, but they want to hear from the experts, the people who are actually living sports and living analytics full time. So we're very fortunate to have a returning guest to the show, Craig O'Shaughnessy. Craig is a strategy analyst for the ATP Tour, Wimbledon, the New York Times. He was also part of Novak Djokovic's team. Not too bad. And we'll talk to Craig about Novak's match today in just a minute or so. Helping guide the serve back to the number one in the world and winning four Grand Slam titles. And you can also follow him. You must follow Craig on Twitter. He's a great follow at Brain Game Tennis. That's at Brain Game Tennis. Craig, it's great to see you and welcome back to Wharton Moneyball.
Well, it's always good to talk to you guys. We're blending analytics and sports and, you know, how does it get any better?
Oh, it doesn't. That's why we've been on here on SiriusXM for 8+ years, and they haven't taken us off the air yet, and we're having the time of our life. And so what's better than combining sports and analytics and business together?
Proven success.
Yeah, proven success. So let's get started with, obviously, we have Wimbledon going on right now. I know you said just before we got on the air that you said you were at a challenger event, or I guess a tour event today with somebody you're working with. But I hope you got to watch some, you're getting to watch some of Wimbledon, and you might have seen some of Novak's match against Sinner today. Let's first start overall. What's going on at Wimbledon that's caught your eye?
Yeah, well, I was asked at the start, who do you think on the men's side is the favorite? And my answer always in this situation, especially with Novak in Wimbledon, is that the conversation starts and ends with one player, and that's Novak Djokovic. If and when he does lose, Then we can start looking at whoever's left in the field. But, you know, in this situation, I always like, let's talk about Novak. He's the favorite. He's the overwhelming favorite. You know, the other guys, someone's got to knock him out. And until somebody does knock him out, it's all about him. And today it got close. I didn't see the match, but I listened to Wimbledon radio. I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm home this year. I'm not at Wimbledon. And I drove up this morning to Waco, to Baylor University, where I am now, which I am a Baylor alum. So it's good to return home. And the player that I work with won his match this morning. He's from Tibet, by the way, which is quite interesting. He's going to be going to Princeton. He's just 17. But I listened to the radio the whole way up. And, you know, Novak had a point to go 5-1 up in the first set, doesn't get it done, drops two sets to love. And then, you know, I saw on Twitter, he's like, all of a sudden, when I broke him early in the third, I found my rhythm. And it was just like the Tsitsipas Roland Garros final from last year, where he's down two sets to love. You think he's out, and he's still the favorite. He's still the favorite down two sets to love. And he did the exact same thing. He found his rhythm early in the third set. He did it against Sinner. He did it against Tsitsipas. And he's rolling. And, you know, and until he loses, you know, pencil him in.
So let me ask you, when is this? And by the way, I say this as a massive fan of the big three. And by the way, I'm also happy to call it the big four if you want to include Andy Murray. Sure. I don't want to diminish it all. By the way, I'm happy to include Stan Wawrinka and say the big five because I don't want to diminish what Stan Wawrinka has accomplished on the tour as well. But when is this? I mean, Craig, you know, I don't know if I have another 50 years in me to wait. I mean, when is this reign going to end? I mean, it's been 20 years now where it's been these five players have won. I don't make it up. 95% of the Grand Slams. I mean, I know Medvedev has won, and I know Cilic has won. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's probably a couple other people that have won. I'm sure you could. I have to think about who the others are. There's maybe a couple others here and there that have won. But these guys are winning all of them. Is like, I mean, I think we all agree Federer's through. We got that part. Federer's done at this point. But like, how many more years? Djokovic, Nadal's holding two Grand Slams right now. I mean, how? And obviously, I think both of us agree Murray and Wawrinka are probably not winning more Grand Slams. But like, let's call it the Nadal Djokovic stranglehold. How much longer is this going to last?
They've got a, I mean, for sure, Rafa has a really good shot to win Roland Garros next year. He's got a really good shot to win Wimbledon this year. You know, Novak is the big problem for him. I think Cam Nori and David Goffin are deep into a fifth set at the moment. So we don't know who Novak's going to play in the semifinal. But, you know, these guys, and it really started with Roger, where they were able to reach a level where they could afford to have a full-time physio travel with them, somebody looking after their diet, somebody looking after their strength. And, you know, Roger, you know, started putting a team together. So, you know, the older way of doing it is the player and the coach, and that was it. And the coach had to, you know, do as much as he could. The tour would provide physios, but, you know, you've got at a slam, you've got 128 players in the main draw. You've got another 128 in qualifying. And so it's tough to always get the physio you want and the time you want. So what happened initially was guys like Roger said, I'm just going to employ my own physio. So if you've got somebody looking after your body 24/7, 365, the chance you're going to age, it just slows that process down. And in fact, you know, if you're eating, you know, perfectly, you're lifting weights that are pertinent to your sport and working on your flexibility and all of those things with the body. You know, Roger started and just proved that you can last. And I mean, Roger floats around the court. I remember a discussion I had with Novak at the start of, it was actually the end of 2017, where we looked at his game style for the following year. What should he do? You know, he's out. He played the first part of 2017. He was out the last half up with the elbow injury. He retired against Burdick at Wimbledon that year. And then, you know, the conversation was, you know, Craig, should I hit more forehands or backhands? We're like, definitely more forehands, even though you have the world's best backhand. The percentages say that you hit, you know, at the time, He was hitting 72% forehand winners, 28% backhand winners. The top 10 were hitting 75% forehand winners. And I'm like, Novak, when the ball comes down the middle of the court to your backhand, run around it and upgrade to a forehand. You know, it's the backhand is good. You know, the analogy is the sword and the shield. The forehand is the sword. The backhand is the shield. Novak's got the world's best shield, but the sword is immeasurably better. And just to finish that conversation off, he goes, Craig, do you think I should go to the net more? And once again, I said, yes, Novak, you should. Your win percentage of the net is somewhere between 65 and 70. Your win percentage at the baseline, you know, is going to be in the 48 to 52% range. And an immediate comment out of his mouth was, yes, Roger's had a long career and Roger has shortened points by going to the net. And that's a good, you know, roadmap for me as well. So, you know, these three guys at the top look around at each other, copy each other. You know, I'm taking information from Rafa and from Roger and delivering it to Novak and just kind of, you know, mixing all of those good tactics between the three. So we got another 2-3, maybe even with Novak, maybe even 4 years being, you know, right up at the pinnacle of our sport.
So before I turn things over to Dan, let me just ask you, since let's stay on Wimbledon, but let's also talk about women's tennis, which, by the way, I know all of our listeners know I love women's tennis. I love watching women's tennis as well. I think it's equally exciting. But right now, total opposite of the men's side, the only Grand Slam winner left is Simona Halep.
Yeah.
But at every tournament, it seems like we can say there's a different Grand Slam winner on the women's side. You know, obviously, Iga Swiatek came in with a massive head of steam into this tournament.
Yes.
Phoebe Grass isn't her best service. Why is the women's side so different than the dominance we've seen on the men's side?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, all sports, tennis is not, you know, just sitting out there on its own with this. All sports go in waves. It's like, you know, the wave in the ocean where, you know, you get a lot of young players that break through. American tennis has just had a big wave of players that have broken through. And, you know, after you have a long period of the three greatest players of all time, there's going to be, at some stage, they will relinquish the top. They still haven't done it yet. But, you know, in the women's game, you know, you had Martina Navratilova that just absolutely dominated for an extended period. And Chris Evert dominated for an extended period. Then Serena Williams dominated for an extended period.
Oh, we got it. We all got it in between. We got to include Steffi Graf, who dominated
too. There we go. She wasn't bad.
Yeah, not bad.
Pretty good backhand slice, if I remember. So, yes, you know, Steffi, you know, I think when you look back, maybe in the last 40 years, you know, there has definitely been extended periods where the leading lady has completely dominated that side of the sport. It just doesn't happen to be at the moment. And we say that, but Swiatek just put together a 36-match win streak, I think, something around that, which is, you know, third or fourth best ever in the Open era for women's tennis. So even though there is a lot more parity in the women's game, we just had somebody break out and completely dominate as well.
So, Dan, I know you had some questions you wanted to ask Craig as well.
Yeah, I'm curious. It seems when you think about the tennis age bell curve for men, so it's definitely elongated because they can play that much longer and it lasts later when you think about it. Because, you know, people like Sampras and Lendl and Agassi and Connors, they all had their last major between the ages of 20 and 32. But with this new era of fitness, You know, Nadal had a major at 37. Nadal has had two at 36. You know, Novak's had one at 35. You know, Serena won her number 23 at 36. Do you see it on the flip side is, and maybe it's because of the competitiveness, it's harder that you're not seeing a lot of 16, 17, 18-year-olds on the men's side. Women's, you've always seen that a little bit on the men's side. It seems like it's taking longer for them to break into the ranks.
Yeah, I agree with that. It definitely is. And once again, you know, we go back to these athletes are now taking care of their body so much better. The injury prevention is better. They're coming, but if they do catch an injury, they're getting back quicker. The science has got into our sport. You know, I remember a few years ago when all of this was kind of morphing from just being a tennis player. And I looked at some of these players like they're an ultra athlete now. And you look at the tennis body and it's vastly different than what it used to be. You know, the idea used to be like an Andre Agassi, where you would, you know, bench press 350 pounds before you got on the plane to go to Australia, take your shirt off on center court day one, and the tournament was basically over. You know, he was so strong and you know, lifted weights, and that was kind of the accepted norm for a long time. And now it's not about the muscle, it's about the tendon. It's about tendons firing, and you get these skinny, lanky players such as Medvedev, such as Zverev, such as Djokovic, that are so slender and really don't have a lot of muscle, but the energy comes from these incredibly strong tendons that don't, you know, that don't wear down. So the tennis body has changed. The athlete is extending their career from looking after their body in a far superior way than they ever did. And it does make it tougher to break through at the younger age, where you see like Cam Norrie now, like, battling it out on center court, played at Texas Christian University, just up the road from where I'm at. And he needed that time to develop and for his game to come together. So, you know, we see Alcaraz now coming through as a young player. We see Sinner coming through as a young player, but overall very difficult to do it in today's game.
So, Craig, could you tell me, what's the major use? Like, you've already mentioned a few, you know, you'd rather have the sword, the forehand, than the backhand, even for the person with maybe the greatest backhand in the history of the game. We could debate whether it's Murray or Djokovic, but by the way, there's no way you leave the top two for Djokovic. How about that? We can both agree on that. But
yes,
regardless, can you talk about the use of analytics in tennis today? What do you see as the forefront of the use of analytics today? Both by players, and also you as someone that coaches and works with performance with players.
Yeah, exactly. So if we just rewind back to the Australian Open in 2015, I'm down there as the analyst for the tournament, and I sit down at a desk that has a terminal that has all the stats for the tournament. And for the first time ever, IBM is kind of the, you know, the figurehead for the analytics down there, but there's a company called SMT that really does all the groundwork and collects it all. So for the first time, I see this brand new stat I'd never seen that said rallies of 0-4, rallies of 5-8, and rallies of 9+. And, you know, what's interesting in our sport, and I'm sure it's exactly the same in business, where you have an analytic that you'd never considered, but it was sitting right there in front of you for a millennium. And when a point was played in tennis, we'd say, okay, the point started with the first serve, and then it was, you know, we'll count that, and then we'll record what the return was. And if it was a forehand winner or error at the end, we'll record that. But what we never recorded ever was that was a 17-shot rally, or that was an 11-shot rally, or that was a double fault, which essentially means it was a zero-shot rally. Rally length in tennis is predicated on the ball hitting the court, not hitting the string. So it's a little bit confusing. So for the, you know, and we've got this other thing that is a huge problem in our sport. It's called the unforced error. And the unforced error holds our sport back because it basically says you shouldn't miss. You know, unforced error, you should put that ball in the court. And it's not the reality of our sport at all. We miss all the time in tennis. So in general, at the elite level with players that don't miss, they're still missing 70% of the time. Tennis is 70% errors, 30% winners at the top level. For the ladies, it's a little bit more. It's nudging up towards 75%. So in a sport that where we make a lot of mistakes, we think that the long rally is good and we think the short rally is bad. It's we've failed to reach the promised land of the long rally. And then you couple that with, you know, you go and watch a match and you walk away and you're talking about the match and you're talking about all the long rallies because they're more spectacular. What happens to us is that the short rallies go into our short-term memory and they're forgotten. Here's the deal. A rally length of one shot, which means the serve goes in and doesn't come back, is 30% of our sport. Nothing comes close. Nothing. I asked Andy Murray, what rally length do you play the most? He thinks it's 4. I asked Novak, he thinks it's 4. I asked coaches, I asked Nick Bollettieri, he says 4. I asked coaches all over the world, they think it's 4-6. I was just in Brazil in Sao Paulo. The room has got 180 coaches and they all think it's 4. You are 400% off. It's 7.5% of all points a 4-shot rally. It's 30% of all points are a 1-shot rally. So this is where analytics help our sport so much. You have players that are number one in the world You have coaches that all they've done for 60 years is coach our sport, and they think something that happens 7.5% of the time actually happens more than something that happens 30% of the time. It's ludicrous. So analytics are so important in our sport to help us understand what really happens in a match, but also to help better organize our practice court and work on more on the serve return, serve plus one and return plus one, and forget about just going out and grinding all day thinking that that's going to win you more matches. It's not.
That's a great point that you bring up, because one of the things we talk about on Wharton Moneyball a lot is one of the great uses of analytics. You've just brought so much of what we do on our show, Craig, home. By the way, again, we're talking to Craig O'Shaughnessy. Craig is a strategy analyst for the ATP Tour, Wimbledon, New York Times. He's also was part of Novak Djokovic's team. And you can follow him on Twitter at Brain Game Tennis. That's at Brain Game Tennis. You just brought everything back home because, as you said, so just pointing this out doesn't do you anything. But now there's the other side of it. You've talked about how to use analytics for training. So now if that fact is true, and it's unambiguous that it's true, now how do you get better as a player? Well, you have to spend more time on serves and service return than maybe historically has been done.
You're 100% right. So at the Australian Open, I figured it out. I took all the analytics. They have a tournament totals page where they'll say, okay, here's the total total aces. Here's the, you know, the average of the first serve percentage. When you look at the three rally lengths, which they record match by match, they don't even consider it worthy to put it on the tournament titles page. So I went through all the matches and figured out that tennis is right at 70% of all points are in 0-4, which means each player puts the ball in the court a maximum of two times, 20% in 5-8 and 10% in 9+. So then I look for the correlation with players in an event that says, okay, if you won your match, did you correspondingly also, you know, evenly win those three rally lengths? So I did it at the 2017 Roland Garros is where I did it for the first time. And essentially, actually it was 2016 Roland Garros, and then I did it for all of the slams. If you win the match, you walk off and say, Dan, did you win the match? And Dan goes, yes, Craig, I won the match. 3-3. I played well. And I'll say, well, Dan, you don't know this, but we recorded. We sat on the side of the court and wrote down points that you won and lost in 0-4, 5-8, and 9+. So it's like, okay. So imagine taking that one subset of just one player and doing it over five grand slams, which is what I did. What I found out was that the player that wins the match correspondingly wins the 0-4 rally length 91% of the time. It's almost a lock. They win the 5-8 rally length only 66%, and they win the 9+ rally length only 57%. And this is, you know, if we ever had an analytic in tennis that says, Craig, do you have anything that just says, show me an analytic of winning? Just winning. That's all I care about. Not forehands, not backhands, not net play, just winning. This is it. So, you know, showing this to Novak helps him understand the sport that he's playing, helps him, you know, look for the points that matter most out there on the court, but also helps shape the practice court. So if you win the short rallies, and it's not even so much even a tennis statistic, it's just a pie chart. If you have 70% of points accumulated into one part of a pie and 30% in the others, it's common sense. It's common sense that you must work more on the 0-4 because it's a bigger slice of the pie. And with tennis being 70% errors, the number one thing you want to do in a match is to make the opponent miss one of their first two shots. It's the first two balls in the court matter more than all the shots that follow.
Let me throw things back over to Dan to throw in a next question.
Yeah, my question would be, when you do your data analytics, how much do you look at the surface? So, you know, someone like Nadal, who's won 14 titles on clay and two on grass, where he sits today, you know, and is in the quarters of Wimbledon. Do you think over time, is it more that they identify how to play differently? Do they train differently? Like, because for a while he was really inefficient at Wimbledon. Do you think is it preparation? Is it what's the data tell you about people and surfaces?
So the surface is going to have an impact in two very specific areas. One is with your foot. How do you slide on it? How does your foot interact? Do you try and stop and change direction and you just keep going, which is quite often what happens on grass? or can you dig in and stop, which is going to be much more on a hard court. The second is the ball. Is the ball going to react? So out of a clay court, especially at Roland Garros on court Philippe Chatrier on center court, you know, it's such a hard clay court that, you know, our image of a clay court is, you know, we can stand out on the court and reach down and kind of scoop up, you know, a little bit of clay. But, you know, the modern clay court is so hard and such a high bouncing court. And it's very difficult quite often to reach down and, you know, you need a scraper to dig any loose stuff out of that. So, you know, what's happening in today's game when you look at, especially when you look at the US Open, the US Open used to be quicker. They used to have quicker courts. And what they've done, it's very, very simple to do, is they put sand in the upper layer of paint on the court. So, you know, back 2017, 2018, 2019, I would be going to the US Open, working with players or doing writing and analytics for the tournament. I would put my hand down on that US Open court, rub it back and forth. Nothing I've ever touched felt exactly like sandpaper than that court. And what they were finding, what they were using for quite some time, a triangular piece of sand, but that got worn down. So then they started putting rounder pieces of sand in there. But it just slows the court down. In fact, I did a three-year study, 2017, 2018, 2019, head-to-head Roland Garros versus US Open. There were more rallies in 0-4 at Roland Garros than there were at US Open. So our surfaces are coming together. Essentially, the Australian Open is around 70% on average year to year of 0-4. Wimbledon's only at 71, and that's dropping a lot. US Open is dropping down to about 68, and Roland Garros is 67-68%. So there's only about a 3-4 percentage gap in 0-4 through the surfaces. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think having a lot of different surfaces and speeds, you know, enables different players to kind of, you know, develop different strengths and be better. But, you know, at the moment, the Wimbledon grass court that we're looking at is about as slow a grass court as you'll ever see. So that does help Rafa definitely to not have somebody to come out and just play through him, which is certainly possible.
I'm glad to hear, Craig, that you said that, because I've been watching all of Wimbledon and it seemed that was what I've noticed as well. I just don't think people are going to be able to blow through, not just Rafa, but even, you know, big servers just blowing through even Djokovic. Yeah. We only have about a minute to go, so I wanted to ask you, I have to ask about this year's Wimbledon. Can Nick Kyrgios win it all?
Oh, man. Well, the one player that he does do well out of the big guys is Rafa. So, you know, it's if he gets there and he gets Rafa, then that's a possibility. He was carrying a bit of a shoulder niggle, which is a problem. We had some news come out of Australia that he's going to have to go to court when he goes back. You know, something that is going to be a big distraction. The press are going to ask him all about that and probably try to distract him with that as well. So he's a long shot. At the moment, it's Novak. You know, if I had to say second or third, I would say definitely Rafa would be second. And then, you know, probably Cam Norrie and, you know, I don't even know if he's won or lost his match. It's probably deep into that fifth set at the moment, and then Kyrgios. So yeah, listen, he's a chance. He's a shot, but there's so many things, you know, the wheels can come off quite quickly with Nick, and let's just hope they don't.
Just so you know, Craig, as we're taping, Cam Norrie is up 6-5 in the fifth with a match point at 40-30. So we're right near the end of that match, but it's obviously a very tight match. Well, Craig, yeah, exactly. I want to thank you for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball. We've been talking to Craig O'Shaughnessy. Craig's a strategy analyst for the ATP Tour, Wimbledon, New York Times, worked with lots of tennis players. Obviously, I assume the most famous player he's worked with is he's part of Novak Djokovic's team. And, of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Brain Game Tennis. So, Craig, thank you for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball.
Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you. So just one last thing, Dan, in the last, like, 30 seconds we have. What are you looking for in the rest of the, if you had to name one thing in 15 seconds, Dan, what are you looking for in the rest of the sports season? Whether it's MLB, tennis, golf, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, the kickoff of the college and NFL season. It's the greatest time of sports. Baseball's heads to playoffs. You've got the US Open in tennis, but football is still America's sport. And I think, hate to tell you this, but it's, you know, most fans pick it over baseball. I think that's a wonderful time of the year. So I'm looking forward to opening day kickoff.
Well, Dan, I want to give you my deepest thanks for joining me here as co-host on Morton Moneyball. You know, you're welcome back anytime. It doesn't have to just be me and you. But again, I've been joined by Dan Schwab. Dan is a friend of the show, multiple time guest host now, fellow Wharton alum and co-president of D&H Distribution. So, Dan, thank you for joining me as co-host today. And as always, I'd like to thank our producer, Matt Datz, our associate producer and sound engineer, Dion Simpkins. On behalf of myself, I hope you enjoyed 2 hours of sports, analytics, and business here on Morton Moneyball. Between now and next week, enjoy your sports, enjoy your analytics, and we'll see you next week here on Morton Moneyball.